This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, we learn about Project Find Safe, which helps reduce injuries and death among individuals who might be at risk if they wander away, like people with dementia. But we are going to start today talking about the hierarchy of waste. We've all heard that reduce, reuse, recycle, and recycling tends to be the one that gets a lot of attention, and it's fairly easy to do. But did you know that only 9% of plastic ever produced has been recycled? That's because a lot of it either can't be recycled or is recycled improperly. We are going to visit today with recycling expert Jenny Romer. She is an environmental lawyer and the author of the new book, Can I Recycle This? And she is an advocate for reducing or eliminating single-use plastic. Jenny, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
The question that is the book title, Can I Recycle This? Why is that so hard to answer?
Well, we've been taught for a long time that if we put something in our recycling bin, especially if it has one of those little chasing arrows, it's recyclable, mm-hmm. but that's really not the case.
So what should we be looking for?
Well, I would say the first thing is that you should follow your local jurisdiction's guidelines. So they've put a lot of thought into what they want to accept, kind of what their machinery is like, what maybe pilot programs are participating in, kind of what their philosophy is like, whether they want everything and they'll sort out what's valuable or whether they only want the valuable things. So mm-hmm. pay attention to those. And then my book really looks at what happens next. So after you put things in your recycling bin, what happens? Generally, that means I look at three steps. So whether it's collected generally in recycling bins, whether it's sorted with existing machinery, and then whether there's an end market, whether a manufacturer wants to buy those items to turn them into new products.
Well, I want to focus in on that third one, because what happens if there is no buyer? It seems like mm-hmm. a question of supply and demand.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And what's happening right now is that there is not a buyer for a lot of the lower value single-use plastics. And so even after they're collected, they're sorted, they're put into bales, it's kind of like hay bales that are just one material sold on the commodities market. If there isn't a buyer, then that is just kind of a roundabout way of going to a landfill or being incinerated or maybe shipped abroad.
So we might think we're doing a good thing in recycling, but really if it ends up that it's somewhat likely to not be recycled, it's just sort of passing the buck. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also all of this comes with greenhouse gas emissions. So we're putting a lot of energy, you know, human labor into all of this and expending a lot of greenhouse gas emissions in doing all of this collection and sorting and sell and trying to sell these materials that there isn't a buyer for. But I would say that part of it is that the plastics industry has spent so much time and money over the last couple decades on promoting plastics as recyclable and as kind of as just one thing, when we really need to think about it in a different way, to look at some plastics are very valuable and others aren't. And so, for example, with HDPE, that's number two resin, bottles and jugs, like milk jugs and sometimes some shampoo containers, those are really the most valuable plastics on the market right now. Those sell for about $1,000 a ton on the commodities market. And on the other hand, lower value stuff that have the numbers 3 through 7 on the bottom, those sell for about -$17 a ton. So that means that not only does no one want to pay you for them, you still have to pay someone to haul them away. And so if we, you know, think about it that way, both when you're at the store and buying things and when we're developing policies, to really develop policies that are that look at what the reality is on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking right now, you know, especially during a pandemic, kids are sometimes in school, sometimes not. People are working from home, sometimes not. They're going to the grocery store, sometimes just flying by the seat of their pants to get some food on the table. Looking at every single item and saying, is this recyclable number 3 through 7? Can you help us in the sense of what are some of the more common items that would be that less valuable plastic?
Sure. So I would say that, first of all, try to avoid plastic as much as you can. So doing things like, you know, a lot of people are at home now, so maybe using a little bit less single-use plastic than they otherwise would. But if you're, if and when we are out and about, you know, bringing your own grocery bag, bringing your own water bottle that's a reusable bottle, those are really the best ways to avoid, avoiding plastic is really the best. So concentrating on, you know, the three R's, reduction and reuse, before even talking about recycling. So let's say that first. And then, second, a couple of take homes about recycling are that bigger items are more likely to be, make it through the recycling facilities. So recycling facilities, depending on where you are, some of them are mostly just a conveyor belt where people are picking out, kind of the valuable recyclables. Others are very, have a lot of fancy machinery, a lot of gears. And so things can get, so really small items can get, kind of fall through the cracks at recycling facilities. Mm. So if something is really small, like maybe a coffee pod or a condiment cup, things like that, those are very unlikely to be recycled. The industry calls them smalls if they're less than 2 inches. So, you know, if you see something that's really a small single use item, try to avoid those because they're very likely not recyclable. Another thing is multi-layer packaging, something that's made of more than one material. Generally, the material that's the most recyclable tends to be just made of one type of resin. And so if you see maybe like a juice pouch that is made from multi-layered laminate, that's not going to be recyclable.
I want to go back to that hierarchy of waste where you said put that reduce and reuse ahead of that recycle. What are some of the environmental concerns with recycling itself?
Recycling does involve some greenhouse gases, so all of that transport and processing. But I would look for it when you're kind of going to reduce or reuse instead of recycling, you're also avoiding any kind of, you're avoiding that any chance that something wouldn't be recycled. When a product is produced, you first have to think about the extraction of those resources. So with plastics, you're thinking about extraction of petrochemicals. So maybe, so drilling or fracking, things like that. With aluminum, thinking about extraction of bauxite ore to make aluminum cans. Those are all really harmful to the environment. So if you're reducing or reusing, you're definitely avoiding that. You're probably avoiding it with recycling as well. And then just the production of goods, that causes a lot of greenhouse gases as well. The transportation, and then ultimately the disposal. With recycling, if something is effectively recycled, you're avoiding the disposal, the impacts of disposal, and so that's great. But you can really avoid all of that by reducing and reusing.
What are some of the most common things that we think we're recycling that we're actually, I think the term is wish cycling?
Right. One big thing are what we call tanglers, things that really get caught up in the recycling system, get caught in the gears, and cost your local recycling facilities money. One big tangler that people love to wish cycle are plastic bags. Mm-hmm. So people, 97% of curbside programs in the U.S. do not accept plastic carryout bags. Sometimes you can take them to grocery stores and things to recycle, But if you put them in your curbside bins, those are really going to clog up the gears of a recycling machinery. Other things that are tanglers are things like garden hoses and extension cords. People, you know, I wouldn't think to put them in my bin, but from a lot of the local facilities I've talked to, those are some of the top tanglers that really clog up their system.
Hmm. What have you been watching since the beginning of the pandemic? One thing I noticed right away, a lot of grocery stores stopped letting you bring in a reusable bag.
Yeah, and my background, I'm an attorney, and my background really has been with plastic bag laws. I was in law school back in San Francisco in 2006, 2007, when the bag law was adopted there. And I volunteered with the Board of Supervisors office and kind of became a point person about bags and really decided to make myself the expert and created my own website called plasticbaglaws.org about 10 years ago. So I've been tracking plastic bag laws for a long time. And definitely at the beginning of the pandemic, I noticed there were a lot of focus on potential contamination from bags, and a lot of stores not allowing bags. There were a lot of temporary executive orders in some states. Mm. But really at the beginning, we didn't know how the virus was spread. And so there was a lot of caution. But since then, you know, now we understand those orders have for the most part been lifted. We understand that it isn't from the surface contact there. And so we're starting to see a lot more people bringing their own bags again. But I think it's still going to take a little bit longer for everyone to get comfortable with that. And I will say that the plastics industry really got out in front of the issue from the very beginning. They had their public relations people placing a lot of stories at the beginning of the pandemic. And they were even sending letters to public officials, including the HHS secretary, asking for the federal government to declare single-use plastics safe. Luckily, that didn't happen, but that definitely made my job a lot harder for a long time.
How do you go about crafting legislation that you do that focuses on, you know, sometimes bans of single-use plastic like those bags? I've seen a lot of comments, you know, just glancing around on social media websites, and people say sometimes, okay, I use those bags as my garbage bags. And then other people say, you don't have the right to take away my ability to have some convenience. And it comes down to an individual liberty. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, I would say people feel very strongly about their plastic bags, I think, on both sides. And it's something that I've been working on for, you know, almost 15 years, and really looking at what legislation is effective. Mm-hmm. So I've spent a lot of time looking whenever these laws are implemented and when there's a study that's done, looking at that and seeing really what works and what doesn't. And so we've seen that a fee is really the most effective mechanism. Even if it's a small fee, that people really start to bring their own bags in response, in large part because consumers don't like the idea of paying for something that they don't see a value in. And they don't see a value in a bag that they're just going to use for, the average is 12 minutes, for not very long. And you know, there are often very strong feelings going in. You know, the city council bill for New York City was one of the closest votes in city council history. But when these laws are in effect, we've seen that people generally do come around, because they do see a big difference in the amount of litter they're seeing, and they see that really the sky doesn't fall, and that that BYO kind of bring your own behavior really is easier than most people would expect. And that's really the whole point, is to have people remember to bring their own bags into the store rather than getting a new one each time. And we've seen that that is a gateway to other single-use plastics reductions. So people who become accustomed to bringing their own bag to the store and see that they're saving a lot of single-use, or they're avoiding a lot of single-use plastics, then tend to do other things like bring their own water bottle or bring their own coffee cup or bring their own bring your own utensils is becoming more of a thing. So I see it as a gateway.
I know that you are working primarily on the state level, but I'm wondering if you're able to comment from your experience, who is the hardest sell on this? Is it state or local governments? Is it businesses? Or is it the consumers?
I would say right now, actually, we are working on federal level legislation. Really, this started out as a grassroots local movement. So generally, you know, it started out with some smaller cities and towns and bubbled up. So in California, there were 151 local jurisdictions that adopted a bag law before the California state adopted a bag law. So that really, it bubbles up as communities see their neighboring community having a law in place and seeing that it works, the neighboring communities adopting similar laws, and that bubbled up to the state level. But now, for the first time, we're really talking about plastic reduction policy at the federal level with the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act that was recently reintroduced, and that really goes beyond what we've seen at the local and state level, which for the most part have been laws addressing single products, so bags, foam foodware, straws. But the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act looks at the whole life cycle of plastics. And really, one big thing that it does is shift the responsibility for paying for the cost of recycling and disposal and cleanup to the manufacturers of packaging. Mm-hmm. And then that would incentivize those manufacturers to create more recyclable packaging and more sustainable packaging, source, reduce, and ideally really innovate, shift to reuse and refill models. So that's really what we're looking at policy-wise, is really that focus. But I will say that, you know, on the flip side, there are some states where preemption of local laws is a really big problem. And that is including, that includes 18 states that have adopted a statewide preemption law that bans local governments from regulating containers, including bags. Mm. There's one pending right now in Montana.
What's your approach to that?
I like to spread the word about that preemption is something that's happening. It's really coming from the plastics industry, where they are spending a lot of money on making sure, rather than just fighting at the local level in each local jurisdiction, they're going now to the state level to block local jurisdictions from doing anything. A lot of this legislation is written by the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and just trying to let voters, let people know what's happening. In some states, it passes very quickly. In other states, it has been introduced several years in a row and goes nowhere. But I think having people know at least what's happening is a really important step.
We're visiting with environmental lawyer and recycling expert Jenny Romer. She is the author of the new book, Can I Recycle This? Jenny, I'm wondering, when it comes to online shopping, which was already incredibly popular, and then, boy, you didn't have to look very far out your own window to see how many packages indicate that online shopping really went up high during the pandemic. What are you watching in terms of the packaging that's happening around the increase in online shopping?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and delivery packaging is a huge problem. And a lot of it is not recyclable. There's been a shift by a lot of the major online retailers to plastic envelopes rather than paper envelopes, and to having bigger packages that are full of a lot more padding than they used to be. So there's been pushback by consumers a lot of consumer campaigns, but so far we haven't seen regulations to address delivery packaging in the U.S. But I think that's something that we will see very soon. And there's definitely been a huge increase in deliveries during the pandemic.
Yeah. I know it's not an election year, but what do you recommend that voters keep in mind when they are, you know, if this is of top concern for the electorate?
I think that one thing the voters should keep in mind is just to let their legislators know that these are issues that they care about. Even if there isn't a specific piece of legislation pending that you know about in your jurisdiction, still, I think reaching out to your legislator, letting them know that you care about recycling, about reforming recycling, about reducing single-use plastics, because legislators really care. They want to know what their constituents care about. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important to reach out and try to get involved in your local jurisdictions. I've got involved with plastics and recycling laws just through volunteering initially with my Board of Supervisors office in San Francisco. And then I ended up moving to New York City and becoming pro bono counsel to a couple of New York City council members. That's maybe a little bit of an extreme case, but I think being involved in local politics and getting to know your legislators and other people who care about issues you care about is a really great way to make a difference and also to build a bit of community.
And if I'm not mistaken, you recently became a mother?
Yes, we have a little baby named Brain who is 2 weeks old today. So it's been a very busy couple weeks.
Yes. Congratulations. I know 2 weeks, you're still very, very fresh into this. But, mothers have this incredible responsibility and influence. And, you know, when you look at an American baby and the amount of resources that an American baby uses versus babies in lesser developed countries. And then you also have this ability now to look at the world through the next generation's eyes, or at least generally speaking, more, you have a more personal feeling about this. Mm-hmm. I know it's only been a couple weeks, but how are you feeling about waste management now, specifically since this family member?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I've definitely always had thought about a lot. But I'd say even more so now. And I think particularly, you know, during the pandemic with delivery packaging and with presents and getting so much new stuff, it's a lot harder to avoid. But I think, you know, we're doing our best, now. And, you know, there are a lot of resources out there to try to reduce packaging as much as we can, reduce what resources we're using, but bringing a new life into the world definitely, uses quite a few resources. And I would say that, you know, there is that motivation, that, like I said, it's already been here, but definitely is increased as we see this new being that's going to be out and about in the world, and that having an increased motivation to have her inherit a clean environment and to do as much as we can to improve what we have now.
Jenny, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's a great conversation.
That was recycling expert Jenny Romer, author of the new book, Can I Recycle This? You can find out more at jennyromer.com. Still to come on Main Street, we learn about Project Find Safe. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. In the budget bill for the state's Parks and Recreation Department, lawmakers added a study of whether the department should have its own foundation. Fargo Republican Senator Ron Sorvog thinks a foundation is a good idea. He says when he was a parks commissioner in Fargo, the local department set up a foundation.
Because we had entities, individuals, but a lot of businesses or entities that wanted to donate, but they didn't want to donate to a government entity. And that's the rationale behind this, is Is there matching funds? Will people, we have a lot of infrastructure needs. Is there people, I love the park, I want to contribute, but I don't want to write the state of North Dakota check. That's what it's looking, is this a good time to start a foundation in that nature?
The study is not mandated, but it is suggested. The bill is House Bill 1019. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers have seized nearly 2,800 pounds of marijuana valued at more than $4.5 million at the Pembina Port of Entry. Last Friday, authorities targeted a commercial shipment displayed as straw and found the marijuana inside the shipment. Homeland Security Investigations and the Pembina County Sheriff's Department responded to assist in the case. Officials say the investigation is ongoing. And the Moorhead City Council has voted to approve its 2021 contract for mosquito control with Cass County Vector Control, but opted out of aerial spraying, at least for now, because of concerns about pesticides used during the flyovers. Councilmember Steve Lindas says there is a need to control a West Nile outbreak. The city could work it out.
There's too many pieces that we need to change. And so I would rather just take and opt out of the aerial spraying. It's not really needed. And if we did have a pandemic or something that was a health emergency, I am absolutely 100% positive that we could get together and we would be looking at the science and be going, yeah, we're going to address this. And we would address it.
As part of the vote, the city council agreed to have Public Works Director Steve Iverson check with other cities on how they handle mosquito control, including aerial spraying. Council members will discuss aerial spraying again in 2 weeks. Public complaints about the aerial spraying heightened after the die-off of thousands of monarch butterflies last summer following aerial spraying across the Fargo-Moorhead area. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Vanessa Rovig. She is a research associate for the North Dakota Center for Persons with Disabilities, and she is here to teach us about the program Find Safe. This is something that can reduce the amount of time it takes to find people who have wandered off, and specifically, this is aimed at people who have disabilities or dementia. Vanessa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That was a very brief introduction to the program. How does Project Find Safe actually work?
So Project Find Safe works by using, in collaboration with our law enforcement, we use a bracelet transmitter to be able to track individuals down that might have a tendency to wander. So the law enforcement we have helped train through our grant last September to be able to use a receiver. This uses an FM transmitter signal so that the individuals are kept safe. There's no privacy issues, things like that. But if somebody does go missing, they would call their local 911, and the closest officer who has been trained in the Project Lifesaver program would come with their receiver, be able to do their 360 show, listen to the chirping sound that the their loved one's battery would be emitting from their transmitter on their wrist or ankle, and from there the officer would then start tracking that person. So it's very, it's a good technology, but it definitely, we need to work collaboratively to be able to have this work.
Where do people get a bracelet like this?
They would contact us. So I'm here in Minot, but we have shipped them all over the state. Currently, we've enrolled 22 individuals around the state in this program. And so you would just contact the North Dakota Center for Persons with Disabilities or my direct number, 858-3467. So eligibility kind of requires to ask a few questions just to make sure it's a good fit. But a lot of times the family has been looking like at something like this for equipment for a while. So we really want to make sure that it gets into the hands of those that need it most.
And when you say 22 people, those are the number of bracelets that you've shipped out. How much time are we talking about here since the project started that already a couple dozen people are interested?
Yes. So we just completed, obviously due to COVID, everything got pushed back for our grant last year. So we trained our law officers last September, and we really didn't start pushing out the program, you know, doing virtual presentations, things like that, till October at least. So this program is moving a lot faster than originally anticipated, but we are welcoming it with open arms. We definitely want to see as many individuals reaching out. I was able to purchase 50 of these bracelet kits. So obviously they're moving quickly, but there's a lot of other things that families can do if we do run out of bracelets long term, but I still encourage them to make that first step, to make that phone call to me, and we can work together to figure out a way to be able to provide that bracelet to that family.
How accurate is the location technology? I mean, we've all heard stories of following the GPS and then it takes you to nowhere. How close can we really get in on these people who might be in danger if they're missing too long?
It works very efficiently. So as long as the batteries are working, so that's something that I do on my end to be able to help support families to make sure they know how to do those daily battery checks. Because if the battery's not working, then we won't be able to track that individual down. If both batteries are communicating and working properly, it has a 1.5-mile radius if you're doing it by the receiver on foot. But using different antennas that can be attached to the officers' cars, it can have a radius of up to, 2 miles, 2.5 miles at that point. So what they're doing is they're listening for that chirping sound. So the band itself or the bracelet itself is water resistant. So, I mean, in worst case scenarios, they've even been able to track individuals in the water. And it really helps to just reduce that search and rescue time significantly. I think it takes the average search time is roughly around 30 minutes to find an individual if the officer can get on scene quickly enough. So it really is, as long as the batteries are working, they will find that person.
How long is the battery life on one of these bracelets?
So they usually go about 30 to 60 days. So what some families do is they really like that efficiency or the schedule of the 30 days and they change out the battery. But I've had some batteries so far go up to 60 days. It just honestly depends, on the battery sometimes. So you have to get them through the Project Lifesaver program for that warranty piece. But through our grant, we were able to purchase quite a few extras. So we have lots on hand here.
You said that this can help people find these people within about 30 minutes. How does that compare with finding someone with dementia? I'm sure that number goes up and down, but is that a big reduction in time?
100%. I think it's like, it's incredible the amount and time and money, right? You have a couple officers on site with these receivers on site to track that individual, find a signal, get that individual back home safely too, versus, I can think of a few instances, last year where there were individuals that weren't found for days, some very close, to the location where they were found and found not alive. So this program is really a no-brainer when it comes to law enforcement standpoints. It's cost-effective and it works. And, the chances of finding someone safer are very significant. I can't speak, specifically for how, long a search will take. It really depends on the individual and if they have access to a vehicle, things of that nature. But from this program standpoint, I can tell you that the amount of searches that they've done through this Project Lifesaver program is incredible. And it's specifically for if you have a loved one with, Alzheimer's dementia or young children that have a tendency to wander or those attracted to water, specifically those with developmental disabilities. So I really don't know if there's a safe way to, if there's a technology out there, I would hope that our law enforcement would want to jump on it to be able to keep their community safe.
I would imagine time is very much of the essence when you're trying to find somebody who has wandered off. These are people who don't know how to get back home oftentimes or might be missing a critical medication time.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. And we know that, our weather is wonderful right now, but we get a bad winter where individuals can go missing for half a day and we know that they're not going to be found alive. So if we can even be able to track that individual down within 30 minutes, I mean, we could be looking at a lot of lives saved. You know, I know we lost an individual this past spring when we had a snowstorm there and they found him in a field. And those kind of instances shouldn't happen. We should be able to, you know, at least continue the awareness piece of this project to get the families in touch with us and be able to continue to work collaboratively with law enforcement to see this program be sustained long term.
What kind of testing has been done on how these bracelets perform in those, you know, massive blizzards?
Well, I know that it goes up to a very, very frigid temperature, and I wish I could tell you that right now. I don't know the number, but I know that, you know, they are, this Project Lifesaver is up in Canada. They're also in a lot of southern states where the weather gets very, very, very hot, and so I think that it was made to perform under those very low temperatures and those very high temperatures. I don't know those exact numbers, but I know that with the FM transmitter, it does not matter the amount of storms that are happening, or if it's, you know, if they're in a kind of rugged terrain type situation, they will be able to track that individual down using that receiver. So as long as those two pieces are communicating, it really takes a lot for it to have that deflection compared to a GPS, you know, where you were saying we would lose that connection. So it's a much more efficient and safe system.
You mentioned earlier that there is there are some standards that have to be met to see who qualifies for a bracelet. And I'm wondering, how do you factor in that privacy concern if something is giving off someone's location or is able to be tracked to give off their location? How do you factor in when safety becomes the bigger concern than privacy?
So basically, when you're using a GPS system, it is not as safe. So that would be able to track your location at any time, really, unless you know, obviously have certain settings set up. But with the FM transmitter, it's only used in emergency situations. So you know that the information that I collect, you know, for the individual enrolled in our Project Lifesaver program, it's only shared with those officers that are trained within Project Lifesaver. So only law enforcement knows about it. And they're only going to use that. They have to type in a specific transmitter code that's unique to each individual that's enrolled in the program. So there's no way for an individual to get tracked at any time. It's only used in that emergency situation.
We're visiting with Vanessa Rovig. She is a research associate for the North Dakota Center for Persons with Disabilities. We're talking about Project Find Safe. This is a bracelet that people can wear that will help law enforcement and those people's loved ones find them in the event that they wander. Vanessa, what kind of training was involved specifically for that law enforcement part?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So last September, we had three trainers come from Virginia in the Project Lifesaver program. And so what we did, obviously, we had certain standards that had to be met safety-wise for COVID. So we broke everybody up into two separate groups throughout the week. And it's a two-day training where it's both in class and then actual practical application. And I think the biggest thing that the officers took from it is when they were actually out and about, and they would put them through actual mock demonstrations. So they had a bracelet all the way pretty much by the Menards from the state capitol. They had to track that bracelet down and were able to do so successfully. And it was really incredible to see kind of that amazing feeling of, wow, this really works. Like, you know, this is something that can really help, you know, reduce those times of being able to track somebody in an emergency situation. So it really was a fantastic training. They also do a lot of focus on, you know, disability and working with people with disabilities, how to, you know, keep them calm. Because we obviously, if they're in a dangerous situation, we don't want to have anyone escalate a situation further, whether it was intentional or not. So they really did a nice focus as well on making sure that they knew how to work with different types of disabilities, just keeping that focus. So it was overall very well done training.
Can you give some examples of what kind of training might change based on the disability?
Sort of. So they focused a lot on, obviously, individuals with autism. And so we know that individuals with autism are very attracted to water. So when you're approaching an individual, for example, you know, taking your sunglasses off, you know, speaking in a low, calm voice, I really try to focus on when I'm meeting with families, they have an online portal that's shared with law enforcement, and in it, it kind of gives a little bit more in-depth information if necessary. And I really try to ask those families, especially those with, you know, younger individuals enrolled in the program, you know, do you, what kind of things kind of calm your child down? What kind of things can the officer maybe have in their vehicle? Like one for one child, she really liked pens. And so giving her a pen would kind of help to, like, you know, get her focus back to be able to listen to you. Think little things like that really go a long way when you're trying to, you know, keep the situation down in a calm situation and keep it calm. So, and keep that individual safe, because you never know if they're going to be near a body of water. They might dart off if they're by traffic. So really kind of those little things really, really help.
Yeah, I never would have thought about that when you're finding someone, and this is someone, you know, they might not recognize people that they actually know, and then you throw into this mix that it could be a perfect stranger. Yeah, I never thought about that. You mentioned earlier that there are some other options that people can take if they don't have access or just haven't gotten the bracelet yet. What would some of those be?
When individuals reach out, if we don't feel like the bracelet's an appropriate tool right now, we have a lot of really great collaborations and partnerships with other agencies and resources out in the community. For example, you know, the North Dakota and Minnesota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, we do a lot of referrals to them, because a lot of times the families aren't well connected already to other resources that they might be able to benefit from. So we really just try to gauge that when families reach out. Obviously, if they're reaching out, you know, they've kind of been referred by a therapist or a friend, or, you know, heard about it on the news, you know, a phone interview like this. So we really still encourage that phone call, but then we might see some other areas that we might be able to help them with to keep that safety piece going. It might be something that's done collaboratively or done alongside of the bracelet.
How has your work changed during the pandemic?
It got a very slow start. So our grants through the Department of Justice, and it was awarded, I believe, the fall of 19. And so when we really wanted to start picking things up and getting things moving, we were hoping to do the training for law enforcement in the spring. But obviously, everything just got pushed back. But overall, you know, it hasn't been affected too badly. Relatively speaking, I do everything virtually, which is really a nice thing, you know, to a point, but I'm really feeling like I lose that, you know, face-to-face connection. I don't get to meet any of the clients really that we get to enroll in the program, where that was something that we were really looking forward to, being able to have that rapport, being able to have the law enforcement, you know, maybe assist and gain the rapport with that family. Those are things that are kind of missed at this point. But to keep everyone's safety, I think families feel almost better about it right now. And as things hopefully continue to open up and be more safe, then, you know, in the future, there might be another way to be able to connect with families face-to-face again.
I imagine that getting the grant for this and the training and rolling out Project Safe and then doing it all during a pandemic has taken up a lot of your time. But what else are you working on?
So right now, I'm doing a lot of work with the receivers and the equipment. So I'm writing a lot of smaller community grants. Again, this is a statewide program, so this isn't just local to the Minot area here. This is statewide for North Dakota. And so what we're finding is we only had so much funds within our grant to purchase receivers, and a few of our law enforcement were not able to get receivers with the training alongside of that. So we've had to kind of be very strategic about where the officers were trained and where we have to put receivers, kind of depending on where people were enrolling at the time. And so I'm writing a lot of smaller community grants to be able to apply to receive extra receivers. They run for around $1,000 a piece, and so it's not a huge amount, but we definitely want to be able to equip those officers that are trained so that in an emergency situation, we could have multiple officers on site if necessary. Other than that, we are doing a lot of pieces with sustainability. We're trying to reach out to be able to continue this. We don't see this program, you know, finalizing after the grant is done. The individuals that we've enrolled, I mean, there's, you know, 22 people around the state who needed this service, who this would cost our state so much more money if the individual did go missing compared to enrolling them in this program. So as much awareness as we can do about it to continue to push it in the right direction to get to the right people to see this funded long term is also something that we're having constant conversations about. So
you mentioned that the receivers are costing you about $1,000 to give to the officers. How much are the bracelets that you're giving out?
Mm-hmm. The bracelets themselves are $325.
Okay.
So that's a year-long supply. So that's enough batteries and bands to equip that individual. After that, if an individual, you know, long-term, if they enroll in the program, it costs about $12, I believe, with the just to upkeep the batteries and bands to be able to make those replacements. Mm-hmm. So it's a very cost-effective program.
Are you able to give the bracelets out to the people who need them for free, or is that $325 cost shared or put on to the people?
Yeah, nope, you bet. They are absolutely free right now. So anyone who's enrolled in the program, this is a completely free program. That's where we wanted to, you know, see who needs this, you know, what kind of families are out there that really could benefit from this. And from there, there might be future funding, grant funding, things like that to be able to sustain it longer for those other areas. But there's definitely a need here in North Dakota, but we wanted to make it as cost effective as possible for those families. If we run out of bracelets, which is my ultimate goal, to run out of all 50 of them, we would look at, you know, if there is an individual that reaches out, is there community fundraising that can be done? Can we host a walk? Is there a local partnership that can be done with your police department, fire department, things like of that nature? I know through certain waivers, depending on the diagnosis of the individual, that there is funding available to be able to provide that because it is a safety piece. And so there's certain fundings out there that we're continuing to learn about to be able to put, you know, put people in the right direction to be able to keep this free for families. They already have enough going on. This shouldn't have to be an added expense for them.
Vanessa Rovig is a research associate for the North Dakota Center for Persons with Disabilities. You can find out more about Project FindSafe on their website, and that is ndcpd.org/findsafe. Vanessa, thank you so much for your time today.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Dakota Datebook is next.
The newspaper, The Washington Post, went to court for 3 years to get access to secret documents and recordings about the war in Afghanistan, which is supposedly, for the United States, about to be ending.
So when you look at Afghanistan, every single measurable activity is failing.
I can't remember us ever saying, should we be there? Are we being useful? Are we succeeding?
We had to sue you twice to get our hands on it.
Wait, you did what?
Even by Afghan standards, I was in the presence of a totally evil person.
The just severity of corruption in our own system, I think, is just unbelievable.
Tonight at 8 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 27th. For decades, measles was a pervasive disease that swamped towns and schools with epidemics until vaccines were developed in the 1960s and 70s. The last measles outbreak in North Dakota disrupted school events and threatened the state track meet. It was on this date in 1986 that the Associated Press reported 7 measles cases in East Grand Forks, Minnesota, and 1 each in Michigan, North Dakota, and Thief River Falls, Minnesota. East Grand Forks postponed its high school prom. Local health officials urged parents to keep their children out of crowded areas such as churches, shopping malls, and movie theaters. The measles cases were the first in North Dakota in 7 years. More new cases prompted the health department to issue measles alerts for multiple counties and to recommend schools in those counties suspend extracurricular activities. health officials traced the outbreak to Manitoba and recommended people avoid travel to Canada and counties with a measles alert. Measles alerts usually lasted 2 weeks. The outbreak looked like it would disrupt the boys and girls Class A and Class B state track meet set for late May in Grand Forks, where about 1,400 students would gather. But the two-day event went on after Grand Forks County's health officer said a countywide ban on after-school events had been successful. In total, 25 people in 9 counties tested positive for measles in 1986 in North Dakota, including 10 in Morton County. One case stood out. A 90-year-old farmer from Michigan, North Dakota, was reported to the CDC as the oldest person in the U.S. to ever have measles. The 1987 legislature passed a law stemming from the measles outbreak and inconsistent local compliance with state health guidance. The health department's attorney told lawmakers the resulting inconsistent application of control measures created a significant amount of confusion, frustration, and anger. The law allows the state health officer to ask a judge to cancel public events and close businesses to prevent the spread of disease. The law also allows the state health officer to order any measures deemed necessary for disease control. Decades later, in a coronavirus pandemic, 4 North Dakota state health officers used the law to issue quarantine orders and a statewide mask mandate. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
View the Palace of Versailles.
And then you see how vast and how magnificent it is.
Get to know West Africa.
Wrestling is the national pastime. It's the baseball of Senegal.
And why they send a flame from Jerusalem to Athens for Easter.
That light brings health and luck and prosperity to your house. Also, in the yard of the church, we have red eggs.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
When kids age out of foster care, the odds are against them.
She was homeless. She was constantly struggling to find work.
An NPR investigation finds many kids were entitled to federal funds that could have helped.
If the Social Security check had gone to you, what would you have done with it?
I would have gotten my own place.
Where did the money go? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, they say history is written by the winners. And we are going to take a look at a new book that aims to correct some of the mythologizing that has happened in our understanding of the settling of the American West. Blaine Harden exposes hucksterism, self-interest, and explores race relations at the very founding of this country. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.